Srimad Bhagavatam, 10th canto, 1st chapter, the Advent of Lord Krishna introduction, is text number 67. Translation. Kings, greedy for sense gratification on this earth, almost always kill their enemies indiscriminately. To satisfy their own whims, they may kill anyone, even their mothers, fathers, brothers, or friends. Report by Srila Prabhupada. We have seen in the history of India that Aurangzeb killed his brother and nephews and imprisoned his father to fulfill his political ambitions. There have been many similar instances, and Kamsa was the same type of king. Kamsa did not hesitate to kill his nephews and imprison his sister and his father. For demons to do such things is not astonishing. Nonetheless, although Kamsa was a demon, he was aware that Lord Vishnu cannot be killed, and thus he attained salvation. Even partial understanding of the activities of Lord Vishnu make one eligible for salvation. Kamsa knew a little about Krishna, that he could not be killed, and therefore he attained salvation, although he thought of Vishnu, Krishna, as an enemy. What then is to be said of one who knows Krishna perfectly? From the description of Shastras, like Bhagavad Gita, it is therefore the duty of everyone to read Bhagavad Gita and understand Krishna perfectly. This will make one's life successful. Mataram pitaram pratrin sarvamscha suridastata gnanti hyasutipo lupta raja prayasho bhuvi. Kings, greedy for sense gratification on this earth, almost always kill their enemies indiscriminately. To satisfy their own whims, they may kill anyone, even their mothers, fathers, brothers, and friends. This observation is being made in connection with King Kamsa's killing his six newborn nephews, one after the other, called the what? Shadgarbha. Shadgarbha. One after another, little babies brought to him, and whack, off them, like that. So this is particularly nasty, but he's saying that actually it's seen by practical experience that this is going on, especially members of the royal order, because the political ambitions are there. If anyone stands in their way, they like to kill them. It says indiscriminately. And not only, he mentions here Aurangzeb, even their own relatives. But of course, it was always when there was hereditary rulership of royal order, it was always one's own family that political fights would develop. If the eldest son was to inherit the kingdom and the second son was ambitious and the eldest son was maybe a little weak in some ways, he had to watch out for poison or something. And, oh, he died, so now I'm the king, and so on. So Prabhupada mentions Aurangzeb. Aurangzeb was one of the Turkish or Mughal invaders of India. He is famous for being extraordinarily intolerant. The Muslims came twice to India. First the Arabs, and then they were conquered by the Turks. And while the Arabs were there, things were pretty peaceful, actually. Even though there were Muslims and Hindus, there was not too much conflict at all. Everybody got along famously well, found a modus vivendi. But when the Arabs were displaced by the Turks, things got nasty. That was Aurangzeb particularly. when you go to Vrindavan, you'll see some truncated temples. The Govindaji temple. What's that? Haridev temple? Haridev what's the place? Right on that Manasaganga Lake. In Govardhan, there's a temple, I think, Haridev. They go up and then all of a sudden, that was Aurangzeb who did that. He didn't like to see Hindu temples very tall, so he chopped them all off, had them dismantled. They were a squat. So he was a famous persecutor. And they used to take the temples and take the deities. They used to take the marble and everything from temples they had destroyed and build a mosque, and then would bury the deities after breaking them up under the threshold, so that whoever went into the mosque would be stepping on the heads of the deities. This was their mood. So this was Aurangzeb, what he did. People are still bitter to this day about this same kind of thing, you know. Just like when this Babri Mosque was dismantled on the idea that that was the birth site of Ramchandra, that a mosque was standing. And that was also done. Just like you find that Krishna's birthplace is now under a mosque, because they would find holy places and tear down the temples that were there and build a mosque over it. I said, so these things happened a long time ago, a little after the time of Lord Chaitanya, but still everyone is upset. Anyway, so this Aurangzeb, he was a typical case. So he was ambitious, so he killed his brother, his nephews, and locked his father up in prison. He sat there watching Aurangzeb do all this kind of stuff to take over the kingdom. And so you'll see anywhere, you could look back in the old histories, the Roman emperors, European kings, there was always plotting and counterplotting, and these people, when they became politically ambitious, and what stood in the way were other family members, they did them away. So this is typical. Prabhupada says of demons. Well, most people are demons in Kali Yuga, and especially when there's political power at stake, when we find that there's actually real wealth and real rulership, people will do practically anything to secure it. And they don't stop anywhere, so any atrocity will be committed for this sort of thing. He says, although Kamsa was a demon, he was aware that Vishnu cannot be killed. We discussed that yesterday. That he was, in one sense, Krishna conscious. Although not a devotee. Because Rupa Goswami's definition of bhakti means you have to serve Krishna favorably, in a favorable state of mind. Anukulyena Krishna Nishilana. Not in an envious way or hostile way, but in a manner that is well disposed toward Krishna. It is not enough merely to be attracted to Krishna, because we see that the demons are also attracted to Krishna. They admire him, his wealth, his strength, his fame, his beauty, his renunciation. They're definitely attracted, because Krishna is all attractive, so he attracts the demons. But when they're attracted to Krishna's opulences and so on, they think, I want these for myself. So that attraction is not love. But envy is based on, you don't envy somebody unless they have something you want. If I'm not attracted to somebody, then I don't. There's no envy. It's only when they have something I want that I become envious. He has fame. That means I'm attracted to his fame. But I want it for myself. I don't want him. I want it to be transferred from him to me. When a man sees another man as a beautiful wife and he envies him, it means he wants to possess her himself. Or whatever. But the basis of envy is attraction. Just like attraction is also the basis of love. The difference is, love is generous. St. Augustine said, he said, love means to want the other to be. So the demon-like Kamsa says, Krishna, you're the Supreme Personality of Godhead and I can't stand it. I can't stand it that you have that position and not me. Whereas the devotee says, Krishna, you are the Supreme Personality of Godhead and it's great. I want you to be the Supreme Personality of Godhead and I'm your servant. You be God and I'll serve you. That's love. And when all the trace of envy is cleared from our heart, then we're called pure devotees. Otherwise, there's some envy. The envy is there because we're in the material world. So we should know that if we're in the material world, it's because of some envy sent us this way. Bhagavatam uses the image of turning your back on Krishna. Turning your back on Krishna. Have another kind of vision. You turn around and there's no God, right? What do you think? Then it's clear for me to become God. And so you can come to the material world and engage in your little God project. So you can become a politician, for example. There it is. There's king. You know what king is called in Sanskrit? Naradev. Naradev. Nara means human being and Deva means God. Naradev. So I've seen, well, the karmic scholars have translated just like that, man-god, man-god, or God among men. But Prabhupada translates Naradev as representative of God among men. Because the king is like God because he's supposed to be God's representative. So that's why monarchy is actually the natural system. Because actually, the universe, the cosmos, let's call it, is a monarchy. Monarchy means rule of one. Mono means one, right? Like, what's the word with monofilament line? That's the only one I could think of. Monomaniac means a person only thinks of one thing. Monogamy, having one wife. So mono means one. So monarch, arche means rule. So monarch means the rule of one. And democracy, demarch, demos arche, the rule of demos means the people, the many. So the actual structure of the cosmos is a monarchy. But Krishna is the monarch. So actually human society is designed to mirror this. People know that actually that there is or there should be what's called a macrocosmic and microcosmic parallels. So that the big structure of the universe is sometimes mirrored in smaller structures within it, and everything's very neat and tidy. Like if you sometimes see the layout or the way to build a temple. We saw that when we were looking at the plans for the Mayapur temple. That it's built to be a little universe. Or if you look at in Cambodia, there's a ruins called Angkor Wat. Very, very famous ruins. And if you go, if you see pictures of Angkor Wat, you'll see statues of Buddha all over the place. But actually, the Buddha statues were put in later. But originally, Angkor Wat was built by Vaishnava kings. The largest temple Vaishnava temple construction has always happened outside of India, actually. So Angkor Wat's huge, acres and acres and acres. And if you look at the plan of Angkor Wat, in the middle, there's a huge dome going up, the central dome, and then there's smaller domes around it. And then there's concentric arcades going around that and a moat. It's a map of the universe as described in the fifth canto with Mount Meru in the middle. So where the highest dome is Mount Meru. So that whole temple construction is a map of the universe as described in the fifth canto at Angkor Wat. So they mirrored the microcosm, the small cosmos means the universe, but actually the Greek word for cosmos is jewel. Means jewel. Cosmos means jewel because it's like a cunningly constructed, intricately carved, rational. So the cosmos is like a giant jewel with many facets. So the macrocosm means the big cosmos and the little one. So anyway, because Krishna is leader, monarch, so actually that's natural for human society, monarch. And therefore, Naradev. And it works. The system works. So long as the little monarch is the perfect representative of the big monarch. In other words, he's a devotee. Then things will work. But the material world is also an opportunity not to be the servant, but to try to become the master. So when demons come into the material world and want to play God, they look around and they see, oh, there's that position, Naradev. They are wanting sovereignty. Sovereignty means the condition of having no master. Just like the king is called a sovereign, or the head of state or government is called sovereign. That means you make the laws. And whatever you do is legal because you make the laws. You'll notice that if the government tells you to go kill, it's legal. You know, they say we're fighting a war here in Vietnam or wherever, you go kill, then you're a big hero. Is killing a crime or is it legal? Depends on what the government says. If it says that they want you to do it, then it's a great thing. You're a hero. If they don't want you to do it, you're a criminal. So people see there's this position on earth that's sovereign. You have no ruler. You have no one over you. So people who want to be a God, they go for that position. Let me capture political power and be sovereign. Now you may notice that on a smaller scale, for example, what we call a criminal is someone who has declared sovereignty, but his sovereignty is not recognized by the leader of the country he is living in. So the criminal means an individual citizen, but who does the things that are normally the prerogative of government. For example, the government can come and take your money away. It's called tax collection. They just come and they take it. Now, when the individual citizen does that, it's called a protection racket, right? Or it's called extortion, or it's called theft. The government does it. It's what governments do. I mean, supposedly we have a system of due process by which the government gets authorized to do it. But if in another country, when the government says, they can just do it. Here we supposedly vote on it and everything else. Our representatives decide by some legal process. Similarly, the government can kill. Either it can send soldiers off or it decides, you know, you've created such an offense, we're going to put you into the electric chair, the gas chamber, or whatever, and they do it. That's called justice. When I take... Well, what is it called, being a criminal? It's called taking the law into your own hands. Right? So long as the government takes its law into its own hands, it's okay. That's the highest authority. When I do it, then I got problems. So that's where our former colleague Kirtanananda went wrong. There used to be in New Vrindavan this bumper sticker and t-shirt that said Bhaktipat is king. And he really thought so. So he proceeded to act like a king. Unfortunately, the United States government didn't recognize that he had an independent country within its own territory. So, you see, he made a mistake. When you do that, then you declare war on the United States government, and you should never get in a war you can't win. It's a mistake. So he was not a very good king. But anyway, that's why when the individual citizen declares himself sovereign and takes the law into his own hands, by definition, he's a criminal. That's what criminal means, right? If I decide I'm going to print money just like the government does, it's called counterfeit. If I'm going to decide I'm going to kill criminals or kill people that offend me, really, is what a criminal means, then the government decides I'm a murderer. I'm going to collect taxes for the people I give protection to, and so on and so forth. Then I'm a thief. So you'll notice what happens is that when the living entity decides that he's going to play God, he becomes a criminal. That's what it means. Prabhupada says the living entity is a criminal. Because Prabhupada said that our constitutional position is to obey Krishna. That's our business. So in the spiritual world, everybody's called free because they voluntarily obey. There's no crime in the spiritual world. That's why it's a nice place. Everybody wants to live in a crime-free neighborhood, right? As soon as there's criminals, everybody wants to escape. So this Vaikuntha is a nice place because everyone who wants to disobey Krishna is here, the material world. Well, here we don't do so much damage. The only people we harm are other criminals. And here... I'm also obeying Krishna, but I have to obey by force. Again, I think now I'm sovereign. I'm free to do anything I like. I can be the enjoyer and I can be the controller. That's what the living entity is thinking. This is the mentality of the living entity. But actually, we have to obey Krishna through the laws of material nature. So we are in a prison. And everything that we've stolen from Krishna, he takes back at the time of death. I'm proud, I'm sovereign, no one's greater than I am, I own everything. When the time of death comes, Krishna kills us and he takes it away. Just to prove, because it's constitutional, we have to surrender to Krishna. We can't be God. The position's taken. We could play act at God, but then the reality intrudes. So the living entities in the material world, Prabhupada has compared to prisoners. So when the criminal is caught, and in Krishna's kingdom actually, all the criminals are caught. You don't have any time to run around like Bonnie and Clyde in the spiritual world and then get apprehended and sent to the material world. As soon as the criminal intent is there, bang, you're in the material world. There's the free citizens, and they obey the government, the laws. That's why they're free. They voluntarily obey the laws of the sovereign. They don't set up sovereignty themselves. But they're in the prison. What are all the prisoners thinking? Anybody who's had interaction with prison inmates understand the majority of them are very proud people. Nobody can tell me what to do. And they're always getting in turf battles with each other. Because they've all decided they're sovereign. They're going to take the law in their own hands and do what they like. But they're behind bars. And the government's got a gun, in effect, to their head all the time, saying, do this, do that, go here, go there. In your cell by 8:30, and then all the doors shut. Right? So they say, to hell with the government, I don't care for the government, I'm going to do what I want, and swagger around and everything. But at every minute, government's got the gun to their head, and they're obeying. So they're obeying by force. Whereas the free citizens are those who obey voluntarily. So anyway, the demonic mentality, the criminal mentality, is there to become the supreme. It's nice to actually take over the government, then you can write the laws. So when organized crime becomes successful, it's called government. It's one thing to steal a bank. A better way is to become a congressman and a legislator and write the banking laws so you can steal legally. That's what's going on now. You wonder how it worked out that 20% of the people have 80% of the wealth. This is the way it goes. So the people who are really smart, they know how to get their hands on the government and they write the laws. And they can. But anyway, they break God's laws, so they're not really a sovereign, and they also have to be punished by Krishna in that way. So anyway, the living entity becomes envious of Krishna and comes to the material world. So everyone here, we're in the material world because of that desire and hate. Why can't I be God? Why should Krishna be God? So to become actually a devotee of Krishna means not only to be attracted to Krishna, but to say, Krishna, you are the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And in the purport to 4.9, Prabhupada says like that, He says, this is our liberating utterance. Anyone who understands, he says, the Vedic version, tattvamasi, you are that, is actually applied in this case. The Mayavadis say tattvamasi, meaning I am God. Well, that's envy. And see, that's what I wanted for myself. I see Krishna, I say, I want to be the Supreme. Aham Brahmasmi. It's, I am you. But he says, for the devotee, simply by accepting this truth on faith, one can without a doubt attain liberation. The Vedic version, tattvamasi, is actually applied in this case. Anyone who understands Lord Krishna to be the Supreme, or who says unto the Lord, you are the same Supreme Brahman, the personality of Godhead, is certainly liberated instantly. And consequently, his entrance into the transcendental association of the Lord is guaranteed. So what does that mean? You are the same Supreme Brahman. Says to Krishna. Well, you have to say it sincerely. And to say it sincerely means we have to have given up all our own pretensions toward that position. Yes, you, Krishna, you are the Supreme Brahman. Who says that in the Bhagavad Gita? Arjuna does. He says to Krishna in the 10th chapter, Param Brahma, Param Dama, Pavitram, wholeheartedly, you, Krishna. And nowhere is there any desire but me too, or I want it myself. Because if Krishna is the Supreme Brahman, then I have to recognize I am the servant. And I am happy with Krishna's being God, fully satisfied with Krishna's being God, and fully satisfied with being the servant. Then I'm liberated. As long as I'm chafing at the position of being the servant, as long as I want to elevate myself from the jiva tattva class to the vishnu tattva class, I stay in the material world. And I get to pretend to be God. I get to aim at political power. I become sovereign. I strut around for a while. Other people pay me honor and respect. I can condemn with a glance, elevate my friends, destroy my enemies, feeling very powerful. Lord it over for a little while. And then death comes and knocks me off my position to show that the whole thing was just make-believe. I was so powerful and so wealthy, and if no enemies ever conquered me, then at the end anyway, I'm a frail old man and somebody has to help me to the bathroom. You know, I strode across millions of countries and conquered so many people, and now I can't even make it to the bathroom by myself. There's a lesson to be learned. What happened to me? The natural course of events. You could defeat so many enemies, but you could not defeat old age and death. So the living entity in this way, after being humiliated so many times, finally becomes humble. We hope. So the devotee gets out of the whole business by saying, you, Krishna, you are the Supreme Personality of Godhead. You are God, and I'm happy about it. No quarrel whatsoever. I want you to have all wealth, all strength, all fame, all beauty, all knowledge, and all renunciation, and I'll just go on glorifying you from now to the crack of doom and beyond. That's a devotee. There's no quarrel. He's qualified to enter into the kingdom of God. Well, Kamsa's sort of halfway there. Because he does have, there's two things about Kamsa. One is mentioned in this verse. He actually recognizes that Krishna is God. As I said, he can't stand it. But he actually appreciates his position. Other demons, they don't even understand that Krishna. They're so envious, they won't even grant him his godhood. Kamsa knows, although he still can't stand it. So he appreciates that actually I'm going to be killed by him. I have to try to kill him, but I know I'm going to lose. And the second thing that's not discussed here is Kamsa's meditation on Krishna was seamless. It was unbroken, uninterrupted, continuous meditation on Krishna. So those people who meditate on Krishna, it's discussed like that, Brahma Samhita, Yam Krodha Kama, beginning with Krodha. They meditate. Krodha means anger. The demons like Kamsa, they meditate on Krishna in anger and rage. But he couldn't forget Krishna. You may notice that when you hate somebody, you can't get them out of your mind. As much as when you love somebody, you can't get them out of you. You become obsessed. So Kamsa was obsessed with Krishna. So he meditated on him day and night. At night he dreamt of him. In the day he thought about him. And he knew he was coming to get him, trying to kill him. And then when Kamsa, Krishna was coming for him, he knew his life was reaching a climax. So in anger and in fear, he was always meditating. So because he was always meditating on Krishna, he was Krishna conscious. But it's not counted as devotional service because it's not favorable. So because of that, he was killed by Krishna and could attain impersonal liberation, but could not actually attain Krishna's association. He didn't want that association. In spite of his continuous meditation, he was hostile. So the impersonalists and the demons, they achieve both the same position, because both of them are hostile to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The demons openly so, and the impersonalists covertly hostile. But both of them are. Do not want to see that Krishna is an eternal individual, the master, and I am the eternal individual, the servant. They can't stand it, the Maya bodies, either. So the hostility is there. So any questions, comments? Yeah?
Seems that Prabhupada is always glorifying monarchy, and he always puts down democracy.
Yeah, he does. When all the fools get together and elect the biggest fool. Think that's inaccurate? Because it's hard to find a good monarch. GBC is not a democracy. Properly speaking, it's an oligarchy. Democracy means the rule of everybody. Oligarchy means the rule of a select few. Anyway, this is not a kingdom. ISKCON is not a sovereign state. It's an ecclesiastical institution. And Brahmins, among Brahmins, the relationship isn't monarchical. Among Brahmins, what's the word?
Collegiality.
Thank you very much. Yeah, there's collegiality. So it's a different kind of, it's like ISKCON is ultimately a Brahminical institution. It's not a sovereign state. And monarchy has been abolished because there are simply no fit monarchs. That's the problem. They all became corrupted and they don't exist anymore. Of course, what you always replace them with is worse than they are. But that's the reason. So if you could again have kshatriyas, then the world would be, but they have to be real kshatriyas, and for that you need real Brahmins to guide them and teach them, train them. It won't work. We have to stop now, I'm sorry. Do you have one question? Okay. Advanced? More advanced. Well, let's just say he's in a better position. Prabhupada said, he wrote in a letter, if you have to hate, hate Krishna. Because then Krishna will come and kill you and you'll be liberated. So it's better to be in that position than to just be indifferent. It's true. But I don't know if I want to use the word spiritually advanced. I would hesitate to say that. That I can say. But you're better off, yeah. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.